Lecture 17, The Unemployment Inflation Trade-Off.
There are a lot of jokes about economists not agreeing with each other. Did you hear about the version of Trivial Pursuit for economists? It's a version that has 1,000 questions but 10,000 answers. Did you ever hear that if you took all the economists in the world and laid them end to end, they wouldn't reach a conclusion? Why is it that economists disagree? It seems like a lot of the theories we're presenting, a lot of the arguments, are fairly straightforward. They sort of flow, at least in some direction. Why is it that economists disagree seriously about different ways in which the world works? The starting point for thinking about why economists disagree on macroeconomics is to begin with the Phillips curve. It takes a real discovery to have a curve named after you, and the discovery of Alden William Hausgoe Phillips, a British economist from earlier this century, is indeed a remarkable one. Phillips came up with this idea. Think of a curve which has unemployment on the horizontal axis, and inflation on the vertical axis. The Phillips curve represents a trade-off between these two things, inflation and unemployment. So the curve sketches out a line where the economy either has high inflation and low unemployment, or as you work your way down the curve, low inflation but high unemployment. The notion somehow is that these two move against each other, that one will be high when the other is low. Phillips actually graphed British data for about 60 years, going back into the late 19th century and then up into the 20th century, and plotted points for each year. So each year he plotted on this graph the unemployment rate and the inflation rate, and sort of remarkably enough, when you draw a curve through these points, roughly speaking, you get a nicely shaped curve, which would seem to imply that the economy does move along this curve, where either inflation is high or unemployment is high, but you're moving back and forth between those two things. Now, if you think about this idea of a trade-off between unemployment and inflation, that really shouldn't come as an enormous shock to anyone who's been listening to these lectures up until this point. Think of some of the connections that we've already come up with between these two. When we talked about fiscal and monetary policy, and we said, well, they could be expansionary or contractionary, that is, they could be loose or tight, we were saying that loose and expansionary policies would tend to fight unemployment but make inflation worse. And on the flip side, the policies to fight inflation, that is, tight policies or contractionary fiscal and monetary policies, those would pull demand out of the economy. They would tend to make fewer dollars chasing goods. They would fight inflation, but in doing that, they might make cyclical unemployment worse. So that whole idea of that trade-off between unemployment and inflation flows in a fairly natural way out of our discussion of fiscal and monetary policy. You can also think of it in terms of sort of how things would work in the labor market. If you imagine a labor market that has really high unemployment, lots and lots of unemployed people out there, what you would expect in that particular labor market is that wages would not be going up very much. And if wages aren't going up very much, that would tend to hold inflation down. It would prevent cost push inflation from getting started. It would break the cycle of inflation happening in the economy. On the flip side, if you imagine an economy which has really low unemployment, where unemployment is really at a lower level, then that's a situation where it might be hard for employers to get workers. You would expect wages to be bidding up a little bit at a time, getting a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. And as a result, that would be an economy which was more prone to inflation, where those increases in wages might lead to cost push inflation, or at least would be a way of passing through inflation and continuing a cycle of inflationary expectations. So from that point of view as well, if you think about the labor market and unemployment, this trade-off between unemployment and inflation that the Phillips curve describes shouldn't really be unexpected. And what Phillips really showed was that you could imagine the economy going through cycles. In cycles when the economy is in bad times, in a recession, then you're in a situation where unemployment is high, but inflation is pretty low. And at other times, when the economy is doing really well, you expect to be in a situation where unemployment is pretty low, but as the economy does better and better, goes faster and faster, you can get into inflationary situations where there are too many So in the cycle of the economy, you can almost see it in the data. The economy is kind of moving up and down the Phillips curve from one place to another. What about the U.S. experience? Well, if you take the United States economy and you take data from, say, 1950 up to 1969, and you sketch out a Phillips curve, that is, you put unemployment on one axis and inflation, say, as measured by the Consumer Price Index on the other axis, what you actually find is something that looks a great deal like a Phillips curve. The data has this nice sort of curved shape. You don't really have to imagine very much that there is a curve there and that it works pretty well for the U.S. economy. And in fact, this is a fairly proud discovery of economics through the late 1950s and early 1960s. This idea of a Phillips curve where the economy moved up and down the curve was something that economists at the time really saw as a cornerstone of thinking about economic policy. And in fact, as they thought about the Phillips curve, they would sort of say, what we really need to think about as a society is which point do we prefer on this Phillips curve? Do we want points with higher inflation but the low unemployment? Or do we want points at the other end? Do we want points somewhere in the middle? So it was kind of thought of that the goal of fiscal and monetary policy was to help select the right choice along the Phillips curve for what the economy should be at and what we would like to have the economy at in a political sense. Well, anything that works that well is bound to have some problems eventually, and the Phillips curve ran into some serious problems. There were a lot of doubts raised about the Phillips curve at various times, but it worked so well that the fact that it worked really seemed to make people believe that it would continue working. In 1968, however, famous economist Milton Friedman gave a speech, which has become ever more famous since he gave it, a speech the year that he was president of the American Economic Association. So this was his presidential address, a high-visibility speech given at a large national convention to lots and lots of colleagues. Now, you have to remember, this is 1968. This is a time when, if you were to graph out the Phillips curve, it looks pretty darn good. You've got all of this data from Phillips, you've got U.S. data, and, you know, there may be some problems in terms of the data with World War II or the Great Depression, but there was still a lot of reason to believe that in peacetime and in regular times, this curve should hold up pretty well. Now, at this time, it's also worth noting that Milton Friedman was already very famous. He had published a number of the books on monetary theory and the history of the money supply, as well as on studies of consumption patterns in the economy, which would later win him a Nobel Prize. So this is a very famous guy who's done lots of good professional work, standing up in front of all of his professional colleagues and fairly boldly making a prediction. And that prediction is, this Phillips curve thing is not going to hold up in the long term. Yep, it looks good now, but I'm going to give you theoretical and economic arguments why it won't hold up very well in the long term. And you think about it, that's a fairly daring kind of thing to do. It really is going out on a limb. It's one of the reasons that whether or not you sort of agree with Friedman's fairly conservative politics or not, you have to love him as a professor. I mean, he goes out on limbs, he makes bold statements and bold theories, and it's one of the reasons a lot of people would rank him as perhaps the leading economist in the world for the second half of the 20th century. What was Friedman's argument? Friedman said, what I think will happen in the Phillips curve over the long run is that the economy will make adjustments. And it will make adjustments in this way. Remember the story that we talked about before in terms of monetary policy of all the money in the economy being doubled. And if all the money were doubled, what would happen? Everyone would rush out. They would rush out and buy things. Then they would all realize that everyone had more money. And as a result, the price level would go up and no one would end up any better off than before. Friedman essentially took a version of that story and applied it to the Phillips curve. He said, what happens if at first we stimulate the economy, we fight unemployment, we drive unemployment down, but we start getting more inflation? Well, in the short term, Friedman said, sure, in the short term you move down this Phillips curve, and that works perfectly well. But in the long term, that inflation becomes entrenched in the economy. It becomes expected. It becomes what people think is just going to keep going on. And as it becomes expected and what people think is just going to keep happening, then unemployment will just go back to where it was. Everything will adjust back. And so you'll get this short-term boost, you get inflation, but you don't have any long-term success in keeping unemployment permanently lower. Well, of course, you could go out and stimulate the economy again and get more inflation, and in the short term, you'll bring down unemployment, but then it will move back. And so Friedman argued that this idea that you could permanently push the unemployment rate down was not really going to work very well. Because, of course, in his view, unemployment's out there determined by the real economy. It's determined by these frictional and structural factors. And you can push it a little bit for a short time, but you can't push those things permanently. You can't change those factors unless you go out there and change the underlying structural factors, the underlying frictional factors, which are causing the amount of unemployment. Well, this is one of these predictions which is famous partly because it came true so quickly. If you were now to look at a graph of the U.S. economy, and you were to plot for each year the unemployment rate and the inflation rate, remember that originally, if you plot those two, the unemployment rate and the inflation rate, you have this nice, fairly smooth curve, about as good as you get in a lot of statistical relationships. Well, if you then go and you plot all the points from, say, 1950 through the 1970s, through the 1980s, up into the 1990s, it just looks terrible. I mean, you got points here, you got points there. The points are just spread all over the place. There's no curve. It looks like the points were randomly chosen. The whole idea of this nice, smooth Phillips curve just comes apart. The points go up, they go down, they go sideways. I mean, it's like a child attacked the page with a pen. It really shows no pattern whatsoever. So Friedman predicted the Phillips curve would break down in 1968, and by the mid-1970s, there are these points that clearly show it's breaking down, and by the mid-1980s and the 1990s, you've got nothing that looks like a curve when you plot the points. Now, this is deeply distressing. I think maybe you almost have to be an academic or an economist to appreciate how deeply distressing it is. You have years and years of data, decades of data. You've got a good solid theory explaining why you should find this data. It's worked out over time. You're feeling really pretty darn pleased with yourself. And then the whole thing just implodes. It's really deeply discouraging. If you go back and you look over time, what you find is that something like what Friedman described actually did come to pass, in the sense that unemployment seemed to keep going back to a certain level. And that certain level was usually between about 5% and 6%, and it kept going back to that level regardless of what the inflation rate was. So, for example, in 1963, the country had 5.7% unemployment, but it had an inflation rate of 1.3% that year. In 1972, the economy had 5.6% unemployment, but it had 4.4% inflation. In 1974, we still had 5.6% unemployment, but we had 11% inflation. In 1990, we had 5.5% unemployment, but we had 5.4% inflation. In 1994, we had 5.8% unemployment, but we had 2.5% inflation. So what seemed to happen is the economy kept going back toward this certain level of inflation, around 5.5%, between 5.5% and 6%. And it kept going back to that level regardless of whether inflation was high or low. And sure, you could push unemployment down below that level for a certain time, but then as we pushed it down, inflation would go up and unemployment would just go back to this level where it had been. So this idea that Friedman proposed was, if you think about the Phillips curve, you can have a short-run Phillips curve where you push unemployment down and get a little bit more inflation. But in the long run, Friedman argued, in the long run, the Phillips curve was actually vertical. Now, what do I mean by saying it's vertical? You have to think about it on the graph, again, of the Phillips curve, where on the horizontal axis there's an unemployment rate, and on the vertical axis there's the inflation rate. If you had a vertical Phillips curve running straight up and down, what that would tell you is that over the long run, the unemployment rate stays at one level. Over the long run, the unemployment rate keeps coming back to this one particular level. And it keeps coming back to that particular level, whether inflation is high or whether inflation is low. It keeps rebounding back toward this fundamental level that's determined by frictional and structural factors. And sure, you can go a little below that if the economy is going really well. You can go a little above it if the economy is in a recession. But you keep going back to this one level. Now, that particular level, that the unemployment rate keeps going back to over and over again is sometimes called the natural rate of unemployment. Natural rate is a term that makes a lot of people sort of begin to twitch. Like, what do you mean it's natural exactly? So another term which is sometimes used is to call it the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. And all that's meant by that long non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, sometimes called NARU by economists, is that that's the inflation rate. If you try to push below it, you can accomplish getting lower unemployment in the short run. But as you get that lower unemployment in the short run, eventually it leads to more inflation, and then you come back toward your NARU, toward your natural rate of unemployment afterwards. Now, there's been enormous controversy about the NARU, about this rate of inflation. The difficult part of it, of course, is that this idea of what's natural is not natural in the sense that it's a force of nature. It's not natural like the sense that things float in water. It's natural only in the sense that that is the level of unemployment which is somehow determined by the frictional and structural forces out there in the economy. It's also affected by demographic forces. And so you might expect this rate, this somehow natural rate, to shift slowly over time, to be a little bit higher or a little bit lower. It's not a number where I can say, okay, it's X amount. It's more kind of a level determined by a lot of other factors in the economy, where if you try to push below that level, you're going to have difficulties. Now, this creates difficulties, if you think about it, for the conduct of economic policy. If you're thinking about trying to fight cyclical unemployment and try and get unemployment down as low as we can with expansionary monetary policy or expansionary fiscal policy, then you have to say to yourself, well, we want to push down to the natural rate, but we know we can't really in the long term push past it. If we want to fight that kind of unemployment, then we'll have to go after the frictional and the structural forces. So what happens is that the Fed, as unemployment goes down and down, has to make an estimate of what they think the natural rate is. They have to think to themselves, at what point do we get to where we're worried that unemployment is so low that we're below the natural rate? And through the mid-1990s, there's been a kind of an ongoing soap opera where the unemployment rate has gone down and down and down and down. It's certainly well below that 5.6, 5.7, 5.8 level that a lot of people thought was the natural rate of unemployment or the NARU rate of unemployment a few years ago. And as it's gotten down and down to 5% and then below 5% and headed toward 4%, people keep saying, well, when is the Fed going to say we're below the natural rate? When is the Fed going to say now is the time to step in? And the Fed, I think, appropriately, has been very slow, very reluctant to step in. The Fed has kept saying, hey, you know, we don't see inflation out there. We don't see it heating up in the consumer price index monthly statistics. We don't see it heating up in the wage statistics. And as long as we don't see inflation heating up and getting entrenched, as long as we don't see it getting started, well, we're just going to kind of let things go. We're not going to start fighting inflation until we can actually see the whites of its eyes, if you want to think of it in that way. That's been a controversial action. There are economists out there and journalists and some folks who say, you know, we're in deep danger here. We're in danger of a resurgence of inflation because the Fed has been too slow to act. There are other people out there who say, boy, you know, the Fed should actually act more aggressively to keep reducing that interest rate so we can get even more growth. So the Fed, as always, is caught between these different forces. I think it's taken a path of moderation. It's taken a path which says, yeah, we care about inflation. We care about it a lot. But until we actually see the inflation happening, we're going to hold off and hold back. On the other hand, if inflation does start rearing up just a little bit, I fully expect the Fed will act against it very quickly. Because they'll say, at this very low level of unemployment, we're at a low enough level where we really do need to be concerned that we're hitting the edge and that we could be tipping over into an inflationary cycle. A lot of the divisions among modern economists relate to thinking about this idea of the Phillips curve in the long run and the short run. And one of the famous lines here from economists, of course, credited to John Maynard Keynes, is when asked about the long run, Keynes wrote in an earlier book, well, you know, in the long run, we're all dead. How far off is this long run? If we could push down unemployment for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years before the inflation came along, well, that might be worth doing. I mean, after all, low unemployment is a good thing. So we should be thinking about, well, how far off is this long run where we're going to bounce back toward the natural rate? Flip side of things, if the long run is not that far off, if we're only 9 months away or a year away, it would seem relatively foolish to try and push down unemployment as low as we could, knowing that 6 months later, 9 months later, we were about to get a boost of inflation and we So a lot of thinking about whether or not you should agree with one point of view or another point of view comes down to thinking about this more sort of long run versus short run. Should we aggressively go after unemployment or should we worry about inflation going up all the time? Now, in thinking about these divisions in modern macroeconomics, let me try and lay out four major schools of macroeconomic thought and what those schools of thought believe, and try and draw out for each of those schools the implications of how they view the Phillips curve and how they view the conduct of monetary and fiscal policy. Let's start, first of all, with Keynesian economics. John Maynard Keynes, as I assume many listeners already know, was a major economist. Many people would rank him as the top economist of the century, or perhaps 1-2 with Milton Friedman. So clearly someone who had just an enormous impact on the economics profession. Keynes' most famous work today was written during the 1930s, a general theory which attempted to explain what was happening to the economy during the Great Depression. It's important to think of Keynesian economics as rooted in the Great Depression because I think it really is a theory of the Depression and how it worked. In the Depression, of course, the economy has collapsed. It's contracted, but the GDP has contracted by 30%. Unemployment is running 25%. There's just enormous problems with the economy. And by the mid-1930s, there's legitimate worry about whether the economy will ever recover. After all, the stock market crash happens in 1929. The economy heads downhill in about 1930. By the mid-1930s, people have legitimate worries about whether we have permanently stuck, whether a capitalist economy has truly imploded. And an awful lot of mainstream economists at that time are saying the Great Depression proves that capitalism doesn't work. Karl Marx had forecast that capitalism would collapse, and here it is, collapsing. And they pointed to the Soviet Union and other examples of socialism as really where capitalism ought to be going. Keynes was certainly not in that ballpark. Keynes, however, said capitalism can work, it's just that it's unstable enough that it needs to be fixed. We need to have the government thinking about how to make sure we don't fall into these tremendous problems. Keynes argued that a capitalist economy could get locked in at a very low level. One way of thinking about this low level is that at a low level for an economy, there's not going to be a heck of a lot of investment. Because after all, who's going to invest when the economy is in the middle of a depression? If there's not much investment and businesses aren't paying very much money, well, there's not going to be very high consumption in that economy either. So if we've got low consumption, we've got low investment, we've got nothing stimulating this economy and driving it forward, then Keynes argued, the market just gets stuck. The capitalist economy just gets stuck. Unemployment, from his view, was really the major problem. I mean, you don't worry about inflation when you're in the middle of a Great Depression. After all, where there's practically no buying power out there, you certainly don't have a problem of too many dollars chasing too few goods. You've got hardly any dollars out there in the economy at all. So, what's the prescription in that situation? How do you fix that kind of an economy which is stuck in that kind of depression or that kind of recession? The Keynesian answer is, in a way, give the economy a really good kick. Have the government really boot the economy forward. How could it do that? Well, the government, Keynes argued, should put a lot of money out there in the economy. Have a huge tax cut. Have a lot of government spending. In the general theory, Keynes' discussion is scattered with examples like build the Egyptian pyramids or something like that. Get some money out there. At one point, he even proposes the government should just go out there and bury a lot of money in treasure chests. What would happen if the government buried a lot of money in treasure chests? Well, companies would get started to go out there and try and dig up the money in treasure chests. And the successful companies would have lots of money, which they could then spend on different things. Now, that example, the Egyptian pyramids, those were all meant to be a little bit facetious. But what Keynes was really arguing was when the economy is stuck, it really needs the boost, the kick of discretionary policy, particularly discretionary fiscal policy, to go out there and knock the economy forward. Keynes didn't really believe, along with a lot of other people at that time, that monetary policy was much use during a depression. Because think about it. What can monetary policy really do? Monetary policy can make the interest rate go lower and lower. But in the middle of a Great Depression, you just don't want to invest. I mean, you can have a lower interest rate, but when no one's buying anything, why would you borrow money to build a factory? So there's an argument that monetary policy during that kind of a depression really wasn't going to accomplish a heck of a lot. What you really needed was that kick of fiscal policy to drive out unemployment. To sort of summarize what we might call this kind of orthodox Keynesian approach, I'd like to quote from a book which is called A Modern Guide to Macroeconomics, written by three British economists, Brian Snowden, Howard Vane, and Peter Windrizik. These three authors argue that these are the defining characteristics of orthodox Keynesian school. First, the economy is inherently unstable and is subject to erratic shocks. And then he talks about how these shocks are attributed to investment following a change in the state of business confidence. Second, left to its own devices, the economy can take a long time to return to the neighborhood of full employment after being subjected to some such disturbance. That is, the economy is not rapidly self-equilibrating. You can get stuck in a Great Depression. Third characteristic, the aggregate level of output and employment is essentially determined by aggregate demand. And authorities can intervene to ease the level of aggregate effective demand to ensure a more rapid return to full employment. So we need to step in, give the economy a kick if we get stuck at a low level. And fourth and finally, in the conduct of stabilization policy, fiscal as opposed to monetary policy is generally preferred because the effects of fiscal policy measures are considered to be more direct, predictable, and faster acting on aggregate demand than those of monetary policy. So that's kind of the orthodox Keynesian school continued down up into books written in the 1990s. What would be an alternative point of view? What would be an alternative way of thinking about economic policy and macroeconomic policy? Let's talk about what we might call the orthodox monetarist school, which would be a school that someone like Milton Friedman might feel pretty comfortable with. The orthodox monetarists took a different argument. They said that when you look over time, not just at the Great Depression, but at a lot of ups and downs over time, what you really find is that money matters, that money is central to whether or not the economy is going up or down. In fact, in his great monetary history of the United States, Milton Friedman argued that what you really see with the economy is a process where the Federal Reserve is often making mistakes. The Federal Reserve is often saying, well, let's try and stimulate the economy. But when they go and stimulate the economy, they do too much, and you begin to get a wave of inflation. Then the Fed says, well, we need to slow down that inflation. And they contract the economy, but they contract the economy too much. They drive interest rates too high. And instead of just fighting off the inflation, they drive the economy into recession with high unemployment as well. And in fact, when you look at the last few recessions the U.S. economy has had, they all do seem to follow a pattern where the Fed raises interest rates in order to fight inflation, but then in fighting inflation, the economy is tipped into recession, and we have high unemployment for a while before the economy works its way out of that. So orthodox monetarists really focus on control of the money supply as the primary variable. They argue that over time, you don't really get stuck. I mean, in the Great Depression, sure, but the Great Depression is a special case. Year in, year out, what you see is that prices do adjust. The economy does move. Some folks go so far as to argue that the economy might well have been able to adjust out of the Great Depression if it hadn't been for bad policy decisions taken by the U.S. government at the time. So over time, monetarists argue, the economy adjusts, prices change, you do get some inflation, but you do move back to full employment. You won't be permanently stuck at 25% unemployment. You just have to wait for things to work their way through the economy. You have to wait for microeconomic markets to work. So if we're going to be orthodox monetarists, what we'd like to focus on is making sure the government doesn't make things worse. Make sure the government doesn't use monetary policy in some way which exaggerates these cycles of up and down, that would make these cycles turn into big waves of inflation and unemployment. And our real goal should be to limit what folks are doing when they think about adjusting monetary policy. Let me quote from the same book as I quoted from earlier and give you their description of the Orthodox monetarist school in a few simple points. First, they argue for the Orthodox monetarist school, changes in the money stock are the predominant, although not the only factor, explaining changes in income. Second, the economy is inherently stable, unless disturbed by erratic monetary growth. And when subjected to some disturbance, the economy will return fairly rapidly into the neighborhood of the long-run equilibrium at the natural rate of unemployment. Third, there is no trade-off between unemployment and inflation in the long run. That is, the long-run Phillips curve is vertical at the natural rate of unemployment. Fourth, inflation is essentially a monetary phenomenon. You get inflation out of bad monetary policy. And finally, fifth, in the conduct of economic policy, the authorities should follow some rule for overall monetary aggregates to ensure long-run price stability. That was what we called before a money-based rule, that you should sort of focus on just making sure money doesn't go up too quickly. And fiscal policy should be assigned to its traditional role of influencing the distribution of income and wealth. So use fiscal policy to take from the rich and give to the poor, to redistribute income as necessary, to move income around, favor certain sectors of the economy politically. But when we think about the macroeconomy, the orthodox monetarists would argue that monetary policy is really what makes the difference and really where we should be focused. In a way, if you think about the big divisions among macroeconomics, you can really think about them as an argument between this sort of Keynesian view from one of the great economists of the 20th century and this Milton Friedman monetarist view from another great economist of the 20th century. And a lot of the arguments and disagreements over macroeconomics can really be thought of as ultimately arguments between these two opposing points of view. Now, of course, there are some folks out there who are truly old-style Keynesians. But there's also another school of thought, and that school of thought is sometimes referred to as New Keynesian, because the idea of the New Keynesian school is that old Keynesian idea really did grow out of the Depression. While there are a lot of good fundamental ideas there, they're ideas that we need to have developed in different ways if we're going to think about the modern economy. New Keynesians focus on this question. In the Keynesian school, remember that the economy can get stuck. Prices don't adjust, you're at this very low level, and the economy doesn't move itself forward. You get very high unemployment rates, wages don't go down to eliminate that unemployment. The new Keynesians say, what we really need to investigate is, why does the economy get stuck? What are the underlying forces that might cause the economy to stick, and might cause wages and prices not to adjust very well? Well, there's a lot of discussion of that, as we talked about in the lecture on unemployment. But, for example, it might be that wages get stuck because worker motivations matter. And if worker motivation matters, then people don't dare slice wages sharply. If they were to slice wages sharply, they'd be in a position where their workers would be unmotivated and wouldn't work very well. So when we think about these matters of why prices get stuck, why wages get stuck, that takes us back to the economist's definition of unemployment and why things might not work so well in the economy. A lot of New Keynesian economists focus on how we might attack structural unemployment. How could we think about things like training and mobility? How could we think about redesigning unemployment benefits and rules that regulate business and industry in ways that we could go after unemployment? So the new Keynesians share with the old Keynesians the sense that the economy can get stuck, and it can get stuck with high levels of unemployment. They share a sense that it's important to go after that unemployment. But instead of focusing on this idea of bury money in trunks in the ground or just spend money and get it out there, the new Keynesians tend to be much more focused on how do we actually go after the particular things in the economy which are causing these problems. And so they tend to focus in on particular prescription and particular types of reforms. However, they're very much in the tradition of old Keynesians in the sense that they fear that if you don't do these things, there's no guarantee that the economy will improve. What's the updated version of the Orthodox monetarist school? The updated version of the Orthodox monetarists, it tends to be known as new classical economists today. The new classical economists share with the old monetarists this notion that markets do work, that markets do clear, that prices change up and down, and the economy does adjust. And so they tend to believe that really there's not a huge role for government here. The economy will adjust toward full employment over time. They often tend to focus in on issues like what's making the economy move up and down. In some cases, it may be monetary policy, and so monetary policy in the old monetarist sense is certainly one of those things that they look at. But other new classical economists might look at things like, say, new kinds of technology, which might cause a wave of investment and then followed by some sort of a contraction afterwards. So they argue there may be a variety of sources of things that might dislocate the economy, not just misguided monetary policy, but new technology and other kinds of things. However, they would argue that over time, as these things happen, the economy does adjust back toward its natural rate of unemployment or its full employment rate. They would argue for keeping the government out of doing too much discretionary policy, on the grounds that as the government does these sorts of discretionary steps, you run into this problem where you're taking actions today that won't be felt in the economy for another 18 months or 2 years, and if you're in that situation, you're often going to have problems where by the time your action actually has an effect, it may or may not. There are, of course, other schools of thought besides these kind of two big schools that I'm describing. There are, for example, people you may have heard of called supply-side economists. There are people who refer to themselves as Austrian economists. They're not just new Keynesians, but they're post-Keynesian economists. There are a variety of different flavors. Anyone who knows anything about academia, you know that people are always defining their own little group with its own specific little set of beliefs. Many of these schools have something to be said for them. They're, honest, intelligent people believe them. But I think in summarizing the overall view of economics, this really captures the main disjunctions in the profession, focusing in on these particular schools. Now, this may all sound fairly grim. After all, if two of the brilliant economists of this century, followed by many, many economists since then, have really had fundamental disagreements about how the economy adjusts, how quickly it adjusts, what's the ordinary person to do? How are we supposed to make up our minds about what's sensible and not sensible? It's worth remembering that a lot of these disagreements do come out of fundamentally different feelings about what's the long run or the short run. Almost everyone agrees that in the very long run, the economy does make some adjustments. The question is, how long is that long run? Everyone agrees that misguided policy can work badly. Almost by definition, misguided policy can work badly. But is policy usually misguided? Is it likely to be misguided? Or is it possible a lot of the time for policy to do fairly well, even if there are occasional mistakes? Those kinds of things go beyond beliefs about economics, and they get into almost gut-level feelings. In my family, for example, I have one grandmother, now dead a few years, who grew up as just a rock-ribbed Republican. She believed in Republicans, she voted Republican, and everything she did sort of came out of this Republican background. I have another grandmother, grew up another part of the country, she's a Democrat. This is a woman who believes all Republicans are not only wrong, but probably evil crooks as well. So, if you talk to my grandmothers, I'm not sure there was actually a huge difference between them in what they believed about the world. But they had very different gut experiences, which led them somehow, although they were about the same age, both from the Midwest, led them to have very different gut feelings about how the world worked. And I think that many of us have those gut feelings, that we fundamentally believe somehow, okay, the government most of the time will do okay, or believe fundamentally most of the time it won't do okay. Among economists, there's kind of this feeling of, is the economy half full, adjusting pretty well, or is it half empty and not adjusting pretty well? Those sorts of disagreements are real and deep, but I'm not sure they'll ever be resolved, because they really go back to these gut-level things that are almost beyond the reach of evidence in one way or another. So, in a way, I guess I'm saying that the prognosis for complete agreement is relatively grim. But it's perhaps not as grim as one might think. If, based on what I've just said, because even within this large amount of disagreement, this substantial amount of disagreement, there is among modern macroeconomists quite a lot of agreement. Agreement, of course, is not popular in academia. Agreement doesn't get emphasized because, no one ever made a reputation or got tenure by standing up and saying, I just agree with what everyone else said. If you're an academic, you have to go out there and argue for your difference, your point of view, what makes your point of view different, and by implication, why other people are wrong. So you tend to see a lot of violent disagreement. But perhaps underneath all that disagreement, there is some agreement on fundamental principles. A well-respected modern economist named Bennett McCallum wrote an article a few years ago. And he wrote in this article, I would like to argue that it is wrong to claim, as many commentators have, that the present state of macroeconomic understanding is very bad. It's true, McCallum wrote, that many wildly divergent modeling strategies appear in current research papers, and that a wide variety of policy ideas are put forth for consideration. But much of the apparent disagreement results, I believe, from the process of personal competition among the growing population of research economists. In the United States, there are hundreds of capable and ambitious assistant professors who need, to win tenure, to publish about a dozen articles in which originality is supposed to be demonstrated. But mature and thoughtful members of the profession, even members whose articles feature quite different models, will necessarily take quite similar positions on most of the truly fundamental issues. One would get basically consistent answers from a wide range of economists to such questions as, is sustained inflation likely? Most economists would say, no, if you don't have the money supply going up and up over time, you're not going to get sustained inflation. You may get it short term, but the money supply going up over and over time is going to be necessary to get that. Return to quotation. Another question. Would sustained inflation lead to faster growth over extended periods of time? Well, most economists, Keynesian, non-Keynesian, Friedman, monetarist, orthodox, new classical, would say, over time, sustained inflation doesn't buy you growth. Growth comes out of other things. Another question McCallum poses. Will an increase in government purchases increase aggregate demand? Well, again, across the range, pretty much everybody would agree that as government spending goes up, that's one part of aggregate demand, and you can boost aggregate demand by increasing government spending. Another question. Will an open market purchase of bonds increase or decrease demand? Well, across the board, people are going to say if you're out there purchasing bonds, that is bringing the bonds into the Federal Reserve through the open market operation, then there's going to be more cash out there. And that's understood. That's a broadly agreed upon point. And then he asks the question, can the nation's monetary authority simultaneously pursue both output and exchange rate targets? We'll come back to this later on, but the answer for most economists is no. You can either use monetary policy to work on your exchange rate, or you can use monetary policy to stimulate your economy, but you can't simultaneously guarantee that both of these will happen. So McCallum's point, which I think is really worth thinking about, is that within this idea of fiscal policy, within this idea of monetary policy, within this basic framework we've set up of goals and tools and how you might pursue the different goals, most of those connections are pretty well understood and people do broadly agree on them. There is, of course, some disagreement remaining, but you shouldn't take disagreement among academics as proof that no one understands these factors or nothing fits together. This lecture has really focused on unemployment and inflation. It's focused, in other words, on short-run trade-offs as the economy goes up and down a Phillips curve. There are, of course, other goals out there, the goals of growth and the trade balance, and those goals have not had much mention in this lecture. I think there's less fundamental disagreement about how to pursue those goals. Pretty much every economist believes that if you want to have more growth, well, you've got to invest more in physical capital and human capital and technology, and that's just how it works. But it's worth thinking a little bit about the interrelationship between these business cycle dynamics, that is, unemployment and inflation going up and down in the short run, and the long-term goal of increasing economic growth. For example, if you have really high unemployment for a long period of time, by definition, that tells you that a lot of people are out of work, and because they're out of work, they're not accumulating skills. They're not accumulating work experience. They're not building up their experience on the job. If you've got high unemployment, in other words, you've got less investment in human capital. And over the long run, that should have a negative effect on your growth rate. Similarly, if you have high inflation, and particularly variable inflation, where inflation is jumping up and down over time, it becomes very hard to plan for, and instead of thinking about long-term investment, people start thinking about inflation jumping up and down, well, over the long term, that's going to have an impact on your growth rate. So when we think about unemployment and inflation and trying to keep unemployment fairly low and inflation fairly low, we want to do those things for their own sake because they cause harm to people. We want to think about controlling inflation really by focusing on the money supply and not letting monetary policy be run in such a way that inflation would get going and get out of control. We want to go after unemployment by looking at the structural problems with unemployment. We'll let the cyclical unemployment be dealt with by monetary policy when necessary, but we'll try and adjust our plans and redesign our government programs to go after structural and frictional unemployment where we can. Unless we've got just a tremendous problem with unemployment, for example, we're in the middle of a Great Depression or something like that, we're going to more or less let fiscal policy focus in on trying to get more savings and focus in on long-term growth. And over time, we believe there'll be some synergy between these different things. That is, the lower level of unemployment and the lower of level inflation will work together in order to produce a better level of growth. In that sense, there's a happy ending to this story. If we can figure out how to stabilize the economy and prevent big cycles of unemployment and inflation, we should, over time, also contribute to a long-term increase in the standard of living.